welcome to the Why We Argue podcast. I'm Robert Talese, your host. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Why We Argue is produced by Humility and Conviction in Public Life, a project based at the University of Connecticut, which explores how to balance our deepest commitments with open-mindedness, a respect for reason, and intellectual humility. The series, which is made possible by generous funding from the John Templeton Foundation, features brief discussions with publicly minded thinkers about the state of civil discourse in contemporary democracy. Today, my guest is Michael Sandel. Michael is Ann T. and Robert M. Bass Professor of Government at Harvard University, where he teaches the historically popular course on justice that has become the first Harvard course to be made freely available online. He's also an internationally renowned political philosopher. His works have been translated into 27 languages. He was recently named in China the most influential foreign figure of the year. Meanwhile, in the United States, in Newsweek, Sandel has been lauded as the world's most relevant living philosopher. Of course, I could go on and say much more by way of introduction, but let's get to it. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Robert.
How are you doing today?
Good. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you. Thank you for joining me on Why We Argue.
My pleasure.
I've been following your work for a few decades now, as I'm sure you are aware, and I'm a real admirer of your commitment to, in particular, democratic moral argument. I wanted to focus today on your current project, which, as I'm to understand it, picks up from your 2012 book, which is titled What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets. So maybe one way to start would be to ask you to tell us a little bit about the view that you take in that book. What are the moral limits of markets?
Well, the book begins with an observation, which is that the very question, what should be the role of money and markets in a good society? This is one of the great missing debates in American public discourse, I think. Today, there are fewer and fewer things that money can't buy. And if you look back over recent last few decades, we've drifted almost without realizing it from having a market economy to becoming a market society. The difference is this: a market economy is a tool, a valuable and effective tool for organizing productive activity. But a market society is a place where almost everything is up for sale. It's a way of life in which market thinking and market values begin to reach into almost every aspect of life, from family life and personal relations to health and education, law, the media, civic life. And the question of the book is, should we worry about becoming market societies? And if so, on what grounds?
And I take it that the answer is that, yes, we should be worried. And part of the account, as I'm to understand it, is that there are certain kinds of goods, certain kinds of values, we might say, that are spoiled when they're interpreted through the lens of market exchange. Is that right?
Yes. Actually, there are two objections as I see it. One is, if everything is up for sale, the growing inequality of our societies matters a lot more than it otherwise would if money bought access only to fancy vacations and BMW cars and yachts. Inequality wouldn't matter very much. But where money governs access to the fundamental good things in life, health, education, living in a safe neighborhood, political voice, then inequality matters a lot more. So that's one set of reasons. But I'm also very interested in trying to explore a second reason to worry, which is, just as you say, Robert, that when market reasoning and market values reach into the domain of non-material goods, they often crowd out or corrupt non-market values worth caring about. And we can take an example or two if you like.
Yeah. Can you please give us a couple of examples?
Well, here's what may seem like a small example. A lot of schools struggle to motivate the kids, especially kids who didn't grow up reading with their parents, to study hard, to work hard, to strive academically, to read books. And so they've experimented using financial incentives, money, as a way of motivating kids to get good grades, to study hard. $50 for an A, $35 for a B, that kind of thing. They've tried this as pilot programs in New York and Chicago and Washington. In Dallas, Texas, they have a program that pays young 8-year-olds $2 for each book they read. Now, the goal is laudable, obviously, right, to get kids to read more books. But the worry is that it may actually be teaching kids the wrong lesson, the money, I mean. So the worry is, will these kids learn that the point of reading really is to make money? If so, they may consider it a kind of piecework, in which case, when the money stops, so may the reading. And the danger is that this will crowd out the intrinsic love of reading and learning.
Wow, I hadn't heard about that. And I take it that there are maybe some more intuitive kinds of cases, like you know, friendship for money seems to be an easy case where it looks as if friendship for money is a kind of contradiction in thought, isn't it?
Well, it is. One way of thinking about what money should not be able to buy is to ask the prior question, are there some things money can't buy, even if it tries? And friendship is a good example. If you suppose someone wants more friends than he or she has, finds it difficult to acquire them in the usual way, the person might think of trying to buy a few, but most people would instantly sense that this wouldn't work. Somehow we know that a bought friend isn't the same as a real one. And we seem intuitively to recognize that the money that would buy the friend dissolves the good we seek. So friendship is an interesting case where it seems money can't buy it, even if it tries. But, and this may be true also of honorific goods. If someone prays mightily to win the Nobel Prize and doesn't, it, even if they put one up for sale every year, the good that the person would aspire to would be dissolved, especially if it were known, well, this is the bought one. You got the bought one. And yet a great many other goods to do with health, to do with education, to do with law and civic life may not be so obvious as cases like friendship and honorific goods, where the money will instantly dissolve the good at stake. Hence debates about whether, for example, there should be global free market in kidneys for people who need kidney transplants. The kidney will work. It won't be destroyed if it's bought, assuming a good match. So if there's an objection, it must be a moral objection having to do with human dignity or treating the human person as a collection of spare parts. And people take different views about this. So the moral argument really can't be simply but resolved by pointing that the transaction won't work.
Right. So can we go back to the first argument, the inequality, or the argument about how, you know, a market society makes inequalities matter more for a minute? One of the theses that appears in your work pretty frequently has to do with the ways in which our society sorts people, usually according to, you know, their economic position, so yes, that we are increasingly able with money to curate our social experience so that we're able more and more to buy our way out of having to interact socially and even in casual, you know, contexts with people who are not economically and therefore perhaps politically just like us.
Yes. This is a theme that has concerned me for a long time. The rise of our becoming market societies exacerbates, right, this tendency of inequality in social life. Increasingly, people who are affluent and people of modest means live separate lives. There are fewer and fewer common places and public spaces that gather us together and across social and economic backgrounds. I use an example from sports. Mm-hmm. I've always been a baseball fan, and I grew up in the Midwest and loved when I was a kid to go see the Minnesota Twins play. and at the baseball stadium. And back in the 1960s, going to a baseball game or a football or a basketball game was a class mixing experience. That's not why we went, but it just was part of the experience that CEOs and mailroom clerks sat more or less side by side at the ballpark. Everyone had to drink the same stale beer and eat the same soggy hot dogs. And when it rained, everyone got wet. Then in the 90s and early 2000s, skyboxes came in. You know, those luxury corporate skyboxes where VIPs can watch the game in comfort from high above the common folk in the stands below. And it's no longer true that everyone eats the same soggy hot dogs or waits in the same long lines for the restroom. It's no longer true even that when it rains, everyone gets wet. And so going to a ballpark is not quite the class mixing experience it was some years ago. And this wouldn't matter very much if it were just happening in sports stadia. But something similar, I think, is unfolding throughout our social life. Increasingly, those who are affluent and those who are of modest means live and work and shop and play in different places. We send our children to different schools. I call it the skyboxification of American life. And it's not, so this goes back to the question of the corruption of certain goods. Well, what's the good corrupted here? I think it's commonality. It's the sense that we are all in it together. Democracy doesn't require perfect equality, but what it does require is that people from different backgrounds encounter one another, bump up against one another in the course of our everyday lives, because this is how we learn to negotiate and to abide our differences, and this is how we come to care for the common good. And that's why it seems to me the growing role and reach of markets in everyday life is corrosive of non-market norms worth caring about, including commonality, including sharing common public spaces. So that in some ways, I think, is the most insidious consequence of the track we've been on for the last several decades.
Right. And it's important, I guess, just to emphasize that part of what gets corrupted in market society are, as you say, the kinds of goods like commonality and the sense that we are sharers of the same social fate. These are democratic values that are getting corrupted, right? We often think, or we're encouraged to think anyway, that what's good for the market is also good for democracy or good for society across the board. But it seems as if what you're pointing to is that the values of the market society, when they overreach, actually wind up corrupting democratic civic life. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. And the most familiar way that we see market overreach corrupting democracy is in the system of campaign finance we have in the United States. We're all familiar with that complaint that money talks in politics, thanks in part to the U.S. Supreme Court decision that money is a form of free speech in politics. But the more insidious effect, in a way the deeper and less visible, but I think even more consequential effect of market overreach in eroding democratic norms has to do with the way it separates us, the way it corrodes commonality. And so that's I think, one of the deepest dangers to democracy, to a shared civic life.
Right. So I understand that you're involved now in a new initiative, which involves you joining an international group of students in an exploration of the question. And this is, I was telling somebody about this yesterday, and they said, that is such a Michael Sandel question. The question is, what, if anything, is wrong with a world in which everything is for sale? Can you tell us about the project?
Yes. Project, it's a new online video series that will be free and open to the public, and it's just now the first episode is being launched. Since the free online series of justice lectures reached a lot of people and generated interest, we wanted to do something similar with what money can't buy, the question of what should and should not be up for sale. And so with the support of a group called the Institute for New Economic Thinking, we created this new video series where students from different countries around the world come together in a seminar setting to debate some contested areas of commodification as a way of, we're hoping to prompt public debate about the role and reach of money and of market thinking. And we're also hoping to provide an educational resource for students and teachers of introductory economics courses who might want to include a week or a unit on the normative aspects of economics, which I think are all too often neglected in the teaching of economics.
Right. So how old are the students?
The students are university age, college seniors, juniors and seniors for the most part.
And they're debating sort of particular questions about particular commodities or particular things that might be commodified?
Yes. For example, we have one session on employment discrimination. On what grounds can people be hired? Can people legitimately be hired for jobs? We start with the example of looks. Is it is it just or unjust to hire people based on whether they're good looking? You may remember Abercrombie and Fitch got into some trouble for doing this quite blatantly not too long ago. And so it raises questions about consumer preferences, trying to maximize profit, but at the cost of discriminating. We generally accept you can't do that with race, but what about looks? What about other talents? So that's one way of looking at employment markets. And then a number of other cases having to do with the environment, with tradable permits for refugee asylum, for immigration. Should we put citizenship up for sale? As some have proposed, and as some countries do in effect when they provide foreign investor visas. So we have an episode on the use of markets in trying to resolve tough debates about citizenship. What about votes? Should we pay people to get more people to vote? Should we let people buy and sell their votes if some people don't much care about the outcome of the election? And there will always be buyers for votes. We know that. Why should that not be permitted? These are all ways of testing the economic logic or mainstream market thinking, which often says that so long as two parties to a deal think it's worth their while, and so long as they're not hurting anybody else, then why should there not be a free market? So we test that fundamental idea in a lot of settings, some of them fateful and others somewhat humorous.
And since it's an international group of students, have you found any philosophical differences or any trends in, you know, the students' reactions or their approaches to the questions in ways that were surprising to you? Are American students more supportive of the market society answers to some of these questions?
In the seminars we did for the new series, it's a small enough group that it's hard to generalize about cultural differences. But in the public lectures I've been doing in various places around the world, I have noticed some interesting differences. The most market-friendly moral intuitions, market-enthusiastic moral intuitions, I find in the U.S. certainly, and see if you can guess. There's one other country, strikingly, where the young people love markets. See if you can take a guess where it might be.
Japan?
China. China. there's great interest in debating these questions among young people in China, but their moral intuitions in response to the hypothetical and actual cases that I give them are at least as pro-market as American young people. And this, I think, reflects the recent experience they've had with markets, which have brought tremendous economic growth. And yet, they recognize, as I think even now the government and the party do, that GDPism alone is not enough to sustain a society or a set of meanings. And so I find, on the one hand, an enthusiasm for markets, but also a searching, even a hunger for engagement with larger moral and ethical questions in public life.
Well, Michael, it sounds like a fantastic project and series. And the series is called What Money Can't Buy?
Yes, exactly. And it's the first episode is available online now on YouTube, on Facebook. So you can just check it out. Your listeners can and see what they think.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you've been very generous with your time. So I want to sort of wrap up and just ask one big question, even though we only have a few minutes. So I suspect I know that you're like many of us, troubled by the current state of political discourse, especially in the United States, but not only in the United States. How do you see this new project as helping to rehabilitate democratic engagement?
A big goal of the current project is to try to provide an example, a vivid and we hope engaging example, of what a morally more robust kind of public discourse might look like. We're not very good at reasoning together in public, speaking of we in the United States in recent decades. We're not very good at reasoning together in public about substantive ethical questions. There's a kind of hollowness, emptiness in the terms of public discourse. What passes for political discourse these days in the US and many other democratic societies is either narrowly managerial technocratic talk, which inspires no one, or when passion does enter, shouting matches on cable television and talk radio, where politicians and commentators are arguing past one another without really listening. So part of my aim in the new series, What Money Can't Buy, as in the books, is to try to invite and provoke citizens to a better kind of public discourse, one that doesn't avoid or set aside the moral and spiritual convictions that citizens bring to public life, but engages with them, not because a morally engaged kind of public discourse will lead to universal agreement on any particular issue, but because it will help fill the void, the moral emptiness, the hollowness in that currently exists in public discourse. And ultimately, it will teach us something about one another. It might teach us the art of listening to one another, even where we disagree. And ultimately, I think this art of listening, this capacity to reason about hard moral questions in public, is a capacity, it's a virtue we need to be democratic citizens.
Well, that sounds right to me. And, you know, one of the themes that's come up often on this particular podcast series has been how democratic public discourse, at least in the U.S., but not only in the U.S., how much of it is organized around the objective of giving citizens the ability to find out what their opponents think without actually having to talk to any real person who disagrees with them about anything.
Yeah.
That, the people on the one side of the question are getting their view about what the other side thinks from their own side.
Exactly.
Which seems like a recipe not only for not understanding the people on the other side, but also, just a recipe for, for losing the ability to engage productively in those, now increasingly rare occasions where you actually have to you have to look somebody else in the eye who doesn't agree with you, right?
Yes. I think this is very important.
So the model, so the idea of providing a model of how successful discourse of the right kind can be done seems to me to be a real crucial part of this puzzle, because I suspect that part of the dysfunction of public discourse is that we've lost faith in the ability in our ability to do it well. Does that seem like it might be right?
I think it does, and I think there are a number of reasons for this. One of them, I think, has to do with something we've been discussing here, which is the growing role and pervasiveness of market thinking and market reasoning in public discourse. This has had the effect of crowding explicit moral argument out of public discourse, because part of the appeal of market reasoning is that it seems to spare us the need to actually judge and argue about competing conceptions about the right way to value goods and social practices. Market reasoning, I think, appeals not just because it seems to deliver the goods, so to speak, rising GDP, but it seems to be a neutral way of resolving contested questions about how to value goods and social practices. But the neutrality is misleading. It's actually spurious, I think. And so it's a symptom, the emphasis on market reasoning and market thinking in politics. It's a symptom of our desire, our penchant to avoid engaging with controversial conceptions of the good and of virtue in politics. And so what I'm hoping to do with the new series and what I've been trying to do in my writings is to argue that we can find our way to a better kind of public discourse, but only if we give up the aspiration to a kind of value-neutral public discourse. Only if we embrace and engage with a morally robust kind of public discourse that welcomes moral and spiritual convictions, competing conceptions of the good life, right into the heart of democratic debate. Some believe that the way to a tolerant society is to ask citizens to leave their moral and spiritual convictions outside when they enter the public square. I think this is a mistake, because it leads to a morally empty public square, which in the end people can't abide. I think that a better way to a tolerant society is not to avoid, but to engage with the competing conceptions of the good and of virtue and of how to value goods that citizens actually do care about. But to do that, we have to cultivate the art of listening and the habit of reasoning together in public about big questions, including moral questions, that democratic citizens care about.
Well, that's music to my ears, Michael. So thank you so much for joining me today for this conversation. It's been wonderful, and I really look forward to checking out the new series, which is called What Money Can't Buy. And I suspect that it can be found on YouTube, but there's also a webpage, right? WhatMoneyCan'tBuy.org, is that correct?
That's right, exactly.
Well, great. Thank you so much for joining me today, Michael.
Thank you, Robert.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the Why We Argue podcast, which I remind you is produced by the University of Connecticut's Humility and Conviction in Public Life Project, with generous support from the John Templeton Foundation. You can follow the project on Twitter and on Facebook at Public Humility. That's one word, Public Humility. Thank you so much, and bye for now.